Hello, 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 and welcome to My Empty Hands, a podcast about the martial arts through the lens of Kenpo. As always, I am your host, Reggie Darden, and I have another wonderful guest with me today, Mr. Randy Haskins. And so we're going to kind of talk about his journey and whatever other items that we decide to get onto. That's what we'll do. I usually start things off with just giving a little bit about my background, and I'm currently training in 5 different martial arts at this point. Kenpo being the primary one, but I also train in Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, Muay Thai, Hapkido, and Capoeira. I've also done some Taekwondo and some boxing, so I stay pretty busy, but yeah, let's go ahead and turn it over to our esteemed guest. Where did the martial arts find you? When did it all get started? And we'll just kind of go from there.
Oh, yes, sir. Well, when I was 6 years old, around there, my cousin kicked me. We were at a cookout, and he kicked me, and I was highly impressed. And intrigued by the fact that he could kick as good as he could kick. So I started asking him questions about what was going on. You know, we were little kids, just wondering, and he's showing me little things. And his mother saw that I was intrigued, so she took me and my 2 brothers and put us in a class. And I never left. Everybody else quit training. I never left. So that was about 50 years ago.
Nice. Now, what kind of system? I'm going to assume this was a Taekwondo system, but was that?
My cousin was studying Taekwondo, but my first school that she put us in was a Kenpo school under Kalai Kano Griffin. Yep, Kalai Kano Griffin here in the Springfield, Mass area.
Okay.
But I didn't stay there too long. But ultimately, I stayed in karate because I was impressed with the powers that karate practitioners had. So I stayed with karate. I studied karate jutsu, which is more of the aggressive side, you want to say. You know, before World War II, things had jutsu at the end of it. And after World War II, they dropped jutsu and put do at the end type thing, and it became more of love and harmony. So it was very very direct art. I studied karate jutsu. I joined an association called the Kudokai Association. That's where I settled into. Kudokai Association was an association founded by Noriyasu Kudo Sensei. It was an umbrella organization that housed a bunch of different systems underneath its umbrella, with Kudo Sensei being the head of that organization. And if you and I went to the Kudokai to study at the same time, they would interview us and figure out what art we wanted to study and which instructor would be best for us to study that art under the Kudokai umbrella. So I went and I started studying a system of karate under the Kudokai umbrella. But there was always this burning question before I even got there. What would happen if you took one person and trained him in everything that the Kudokai offered? And for whatever reason, they decided to make me that experiment. So in their training under the Kudokai umbrella, studying karate, I also was blessed with the opportunity to study Aikido Jujutsu under Takeshi Okamoto Sensei, the opportunity to study Judo under Noriyasu Kudo Sensei, as well as Karate under Noriyasu Kudo Sensei and Mark Whitley Sensei. And then I earned rank in the different systems under that umbrella. And then I expanded outside that organization, and I started studying 10th Planet Jiu-Jitsu under Pat Campagnola, a moonhead that established a 10th Planet Dojo here in Springfield, Mass. And so those are my arts: karate jutsu, judo, 10th Planet Jiu-Jitsu, and Aikijujutsu.
Okay, very nice, very nice. Now, just kind of running back to that start there. How long were you at the Kenpo school, and why did you decide to move on to a different school?
I was at the Kenpo school when I first started, maybe not even a year. It wasn't for me. The personality of the instructor and all, just a lot of things just weren't, it wasn't fitting. It wasn't meshing at all.
So gotcha. I left. And then how did you come across the school that you ended up at?
The Whitley family is in this area. They're pretty well known. It's a large family. It's almost like probably the first Gracie family before there was a Gracie family. The Whitley family is that large, full of professional boxers and martial artists. And I went to high school with two of the Whitleys. They're twins. There was the father who was their master, and then there's five brothers. And when the father passed away, the oldest brother, who trained under his father, took over the system and started teaching his other four brothers and me. And that's where I started, and that's how I entered the Kudokai, because that was system underneath the Kudokai umbrella, and I just never left after that, because that family atmosphere, as well as their philosophies, really resonated with me, and I stayed with that organization.
Gotcha. Yeah, the school, the instructors, the environment definitely makes a big difference in how you train and whether or not you want to stick with it. So, yeah, finding the right environment is all the reason to be at a certain place or a certain school. I know with my training, I was never particularly interested in Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, but the school that I train at now, the vibe and the environment was just so welcoming, and just everybody just really, really just kind of brought you in and make you feel like you're home. And so I knew that I needed to sign up and get going with it and add to my already busy plate.
I totally, yes, indeed. As far as my 10th Planet journey, within the judo that I studied, I was taught a technique called Ashikanuki. Ashikanuki is a bolt lock technique. And Eddie Bravo himself uses the technique, but he calls it the lockdown. And when the internet became a thing, when YouTube became a thing, I was just going through in the early days, and I happened to see videos of Eddie Bravo using that technique. And I was like, wow, that's intriguing, because in the judo world, I was taught it, but I never really saw anybody use it. I was, in my estimation, pretty much the only judo practitioner that was actually using that technique till I ran into Eddie Bravo. So I joined his online course, which is called Mastering the System, on his website. And I started studying that for a while through that. And then I own a dojo. One of my students had told me that a 10th Planet is opening around here finally. And I was like, wow, really? So I got the numbers and I called, and it was still under construction. But I joined. I was the first student to sign up while it was still under construction. But it was always in the back of my mind, being someone who's trained for a long time, that the martial arts being such an ego-driven world, and you know how you go into a new environment and people want to use you as that example of your art doesn't really work and this and that. You know how that is. I was like, ah. But I went, and when the school opened up, we had the grand opening, and then just the environment that Camp Agnola Sensei established in his school was so welcoming. And it wasn't the way I thought it was going to be, which I've encountered in other places. It was inviting. I was like, wow, I gotta stay. And I stayed, you know. And we since rebranded now, and it's called Ironhold Jiu-Jitsu now. But yes, I started 10th Planet, and that was on the back of my mind, you know, the environment. And thank God it was inviting. And I've been there for probably, we've been open for 9 years now. And I've been there.
Very nice, very nice. Now, with the judo training, was that part of the karate school, or was that separate?
Well, under the Kudokai umbrella, Norikudo Sensei is a judo champion out of Japan. He also has a background in karate and sumo and you name it. He has a background in it. So his first love is judo. So I studied judo underneath him. He's also an eighth dan in Shitoru karate. He's a third dan in Ashihara karate. He holds rank in Shotokan karate. He's trained at the Kyokushin headquarters. When he was in Japan, he has rank and you name it, he has it. So I studied karate under him as well as judo. So I got a nidan in judo underneath him. And I have a kudan in karate underneath him.
Okay. And in the training, was it separate or was it kind of blended or?
Oh, separate. It was separated. But the curriculum that I teach now is called the Underground Alliance Method. I put everything back into karate the way it was originally taught from the beginning. If the way it's broken down, karate itself, right? Karate was never a limited art that was limited to punching and kicking, the way it's presented a lot now, this day and age. Karate was taught in 5 parts. My karate is taught in 5 parts. So it goes with punching, thrusting, striking, and kicking, beginner level. Then there's a space right here called negotiation space. Then we have tegumi, which is Okinawan grappling / wrestling. Then we have loading, tripping, reaping, and sweeping, which is intermediate. Then we have joint manipulation, pressure point application, muscle and tendon disruption, and vital area attacks. Then we have kabuto, which is ancient ways, which is weapon arts. Sai and tonfa and things like that. These are minors, and this is the major. So we use our minors to achieve our major. We use our minors to establish a space we call negotiation space, and then we have options to destroy with our major if we have to. That's how karate is taught. So beginner, intermediate, advanced training. And then that's the end. So if we look at loading, tripping, reaping, and sweeping, if we took that out of karate, you could call that judo. Put it back in, it's just 20% of karate training.
Okay.
Joint manipulation, pressure point application, muscle and tendon disruption. You could call that Aikido or Aikijutsu. Put it back in, it's 20% of karate. You understand?
Yes,
so things like that.
Okay. Gotcha. Now, so you mentioned that when you go to the school, it's kind of chosen what path you take, but your particular path had all of the systems kind of put together. Did you have difficulty kind of going between the different styles, or was it taught in a way that they just kind of connected, or how did that go?
No, it's taught in a way, because, see, we don't really believe in styles per se. It's just because combat is combat. You know, fighting is fighting, or however you want to wear. We don't like the term fighting. We say addressing violence. There's no limitation to, all right, we're just going to punch and kick. You have to be able to seamlessly adapt to the ever-changing conditions, you know? And the art allows you to do that if it's taught in an analytical way, as opposed to following a pattern or style, you know what I mean? So it's if you look through history, karate, Okinawan karate was more like that, where Japanese karate is more sport-oriented. Because they do a lot of tournaments in Japan, you know, things like that. But Okinawan karate is more self-protection, or Goshin Jutsu oriented, self-protection oriented. So it was more realistic in its application. And that's how our art was approached. The basic curriculum of karate through Gichin Funakoshi had 9 basic throws in it, which taught you how to load, trip, reap, or sweep. You know? But today, if you look at karate, it's mainly punching and kicking and blocking. You know what I'm saying?
Gotcha.
So yeah. we just keep the original essence of it and try to explore that, as opposed to this formulaic type presentation that people are doing.
Gotcha. Now, with the training, so do you have things like katas or...
Yeah. Katas, but we approach them kind of different. A lot of systems today teach katas to get your next belt, you know? So say from white to yellow belt or whatever, you know, however ranking system goes and whatever particular system, right? They go white to yellow belt, you got to know these 3 kata. Then next belt, you got to know these 4 or whatever. We don't do it like that. What it is if I have 2 guys that join my school, and as I'm training them, I notice one is lacking in whatever, whatever issue he might have, I'll assign the kata he needs to know that will correct that issue. And say the second person I notice, oh, he has a problem. It's kind of a different problem. I'll assign the kata he needs to know. So let's say I assign this guy, the first guy, first control form. I assign the second guy, 4th control form. They could, and then it corrects their issues, their respective issues. They'll go through the ranks and not know the same katas. You see what I mean? And then they earn their shodan, their first degree black belt or whatever. And then one of them comes to me and says, I want to start teaching. I go, okay. And then he enters into the instructor certification program, where now he has to learn all the katas of the system and understand what they are for and why we do certain things in them. Now he understands what kata to assign his respective students to correct their issue, where this guy, the second guy, might not ever want to be an instructor, so he doesn't have to go through the instructor certification program. So only kata he knows is the one that he was taught to correct his issue.
Okay, I got you. That's I've never heard that sort of approach before, so that's pretty interesting. So with the when you're testing between ranks, or I should say, do you test for between ranks, and like how does that kind of progression go?
Yes, when somebody first in my system, I only have in my organization, we have 3 ranks: white, brown, and black. And for black belt, they get tested. They have a written test. And then just through training, through years of training or whatever they got going on, I, as their instructor, I'm watching them and I'll ask them questions. I'll listen to their responses. Just, I know if they're ready for whatever rank they got. But when they're ready to get their shoot on, I'll give them their written test to see if they know what's going on, you know. And I'll present them things. I'll ask them questions about, you know, we'll do something. I'll say, well, why'd you do that? What's this for? Why is that? What's the lead hand within our system? Strictly Goshin Jitsu. I tell them, like, lead hand. I'll say a statement, and they'll have to complete the statement, you know, to show me that they understand what's going on. So when I say lead hand, then they'll say checks, measures, clears, and traps. Okay, so they understand. And I'll say, well, why and how, and just ask them, and I'll get the information. And if they are stumbling and they don't know, and all right, you're not ready yet, you know, things like that. So through constant training, I'll know. So it's not where I put them up on a panel and this and that. They're showing me. And a lot of my students are law enforcement, so they're surviving in the real world, you know. I worked in a prison for 22 years, so, and I had a 22-year flawless career, and I was in a lot of stuff, you know what I'm saying? And I left unscathed, where a lot of my coworkers got retired medically, you understand? So, you know when somebody knows their stuff, because they're actually surviving real-world violence.
Exactly. So, with some of my previous guests that have had you know, that are in law enforcement or have experience being in real situations and having to use their training in real situations, I like to ask what are maybe some misconceptions about real world situations. So a lot of us, we train with these kind of ideas of how things go, but many of us, fortunately, hopefully, never have to use those skills in the real world. And I think a lot of artists get into this mindset that they are able to handle certain situations, but never really actually being in them. You maybe, I would say, maybe kind of get a little bit of a false sense of security. And then there are some things that are just maybe completely not the case. So I'll use this example. So a lot of the rise of Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu has brought up a lot of talk about, oh, well, you wouldn't use Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu in the street for this reason or that reason. Or the other side of it is, oh, well, most fights go to the ground and that sort of thing. And, you know, we could debate whether that those sorts of things are true but or not. But one of my guests was a bouncer for many years, and also in law enforcement, and he's like, I've been in many fights, hundreds, thousands of fights over my career, and never once did I go to the ground. And so I'm you know, just using that as an example. But just in your experience, maybe maybe a couple of things that are maybe misconceptions or maybe things that you've seen that weren't kind of really the way that schools present it, maybe.
Okay. Well, let me say this first, that 99% of street fights end up on the ground is a law enforcement stat, okay? That is pushed by the Gracies, okay? And it's not in the real world. It's in law enforcement stats. Because ultimately, if somebody's resisting, law enforcement wants to take them to the ground to have better control over them so they can handcuff them, ultimately. I have been through countless altercations and have never went to the ground in a street fight. Let me say that. How should I put this? A lot of people who think they can fight or understand what fighting is has never actually really been into a fight until you fought somebody who's actually killed someone. Getting into a fisticuff and getting into a fight where you don't know if you're going to make it home that day, two different fights. When you fight someone who's actually murdered someone, the governor is off. They will cross a line that they've already crossed before. So it's a different fight. You understand? That, very important. And when it comes to, let's talk about martial arts for a quick second, right? So in the martial arts world, let's say karate, taekwondo, whatever, right? They have, a lot of arts are punch, block, kick arts. Punch, block, kick. Okay. People have trained their entire lives, punch, block, kick, get into a street fight, and you will never see somebody block something. Why do you think that is? So those are the realistic things or unrealistic things that need to be really focused on or thought about. If in a street fight, two people, say you and I are sitting together somewhere having some coffee and we see a street fight in front of us, you'll see two people just trying to punch each other. Or one person try to punch another and the startle response, he'll smother it and grab, and it's a standing tussling match type thing with little rabbit punches every now and then. If the act of punching is this much of a street fight, why is the concept of blocking this much of karate training? What that tells you is that the concept or the movements in blocking are designed to really deal with the clinch, which happens the majority of the time. You see what I mean? But people will pass off this block thing. If you block something in the fight, you're behind the curve. So it's not that you should block a punch. You should block someone's ability to punch. You see what I'm saying? Your action has to block someone's ability to punch or block their ability to continue to fight if they try to punch you. You understand? And that's a different dynamic altogether. You know what I'm saying? So those are the things that I found. It's odd to me that people follow this formula that it just doesn't make sense. You know, and they follow it without question. So I'll teach a seminar somewhere and I'll introduce this basic code. I wrote this basic code to help people understand through historical evidence of what our movements are supposed to do. So this is the code. It says the first action or combination of action that you execute should have the ability and or probability of neutralizing the opponent's ability to continue to fight or immobilize the opponent entirely. Every action you execute should have that ability, should satisfy that basic rule. If it doesn't satisfy that basic rule, then it is not a functional technique and or drill. It is a non-functional technique and or drill. Anything non-functional is strictly designed to build attributes. Anything functional will satisfy that rule. So, what attributes do the non-functional techniques satisfy or build? There's four attributes. The first attribute, the most important attribute, is coordination. Right? How many times have somebody came to a dojo and asked you to train them, and you were like, all right, well, here, do this. And they're doing it, and you go, this guy got 9 left feet.
Oh, yeah, I've definitely right? been there a few times.
The first thing you got to do is build some attributes, build some coordination in this person before you can take them to the next level. Let's step outside of the martial sciences. Let's talk about sports itself. You watch the football combine, right? You got all these people there trying out for teams. You got scouts sitting there with their clipboards, and they're going, all right, see that guy right there? Yeah, that guy's fast, but hell, his coordination's kind of off. See that guy? He's a little small, but he's highly coordinated. He said, all right, that's who we want. We don't want that guy. We want that guy. Yeah, but I need you to build him a diet, put some weight on him. Yep, okay. Yep, that's what we need. Okay, good. Now, here's the thing. Coordination is something that takes a lifetime to build. That's why we as parents put our children in football camps, baseball camps, basketball camps, and they learn coordination drills the whole time. Steph Curry, highly coordinated dude, dribbles with both hands, does all types of crazy coordination drills, right? But if he was big, fast, with no coordination, he wouldn't be on the team right now, because everything else is a short-lived attribute that can be built in a short amount of time. You could put weight on somebody over a summer. You know what I'm saying? You could do all types of things. But coordination is something that takes a lifetime. So he already did the work. His parents already did the work to get him coordinated. So now all they got to do, which they did, they put him in a weight. They gave him a weight program. He's putting on weight, because they always said he was too small to play in the NBA. You know what I'm saying? But he's building his build, his weight, his stamina, all that stuff. It's all getting up there. So coordination being the most important attribute, with the last three being natural byproducts of the coordination drill, which are cardiovascular endurance, muscular endurance, and muscular development. You see what I mean? So anything like these things that people think are blocks, they're just coordination drills. You know what I'm saying?
Gotcha.
Somebody will be in my dojo and I'll see him and I'll go, he's uncoordinated. All right, listen, I need you to do this. And I got them doing these coordination drills, and they're fumbling at first. Then they get them smooth. I say, oh, good. Now I need you to do this. Coordination drills. And then karate being an art that's primarily taught in two-man drills, I put them together with a partner, and I say, okay, this is what we're doing. This guy throws a punch. I need you to neutralize his ability to punch. And the person comes out, and he attaches himself to him, and the guy can't. This is what I mean. Boxing, right? There's one part of boxing that's a martial strategy. The rest of it is a sport. When two boxers stand there punching at each other, that is the sport side. That's matching skill for skill, right? But when one person starts getting overwhelmed, right? What does he do to neutralize this person's ability? He clinches. He clinches. The ref steps in, because now the person can't punch, and he separates the action and resets the sport. See it? So the clinch is the martial strategy that saves the day. You see what I mean? That's it.
Yeah.
And clinching is simple. Martial arts is designed to be simple. It's not designed to be complicated. So if it's complicated, it's really not a martial strategy. If it's complicated, that is the aesthetic part of it. That's the artistic part of it. You understand?
Gotcha.
It's simple and does the job. That's the martial strategy part of it. If it's matching skill for skill, that's the sport side of it.
I like it. Yeah. No, that's right on point. And I like it. So going back to your journey, the teaching side of it, when did that start for you, and was that something that you were always interested in getting into? Or?
Yeah, I started training in 1976. I started teaching, not really teaching, but I rented a space to have a place to train when I was a brown belt, and that was 1989, I was a brown belt. I rented a spot to train, just to have a place to train, because I didn't have a place to train after that. My main instructor at the time had left away, and I really didn't want to go anywhere else, so I said, well, I'll just get a space, hang some bags, chill. I started inviting people in, and we just started training together. Then my instructor came back around. In 1991, I got promoted to black belt, tested for my black belt, earned my black belt in 1991, and ideally, you're supposed to be at least a Sandan to earn a teacher's license, but I was allowed to just continue having my space and teaching. So I did that. More working out with people than teaching. And then when I eventually got my Sandan, I was allowed to write my own curriculum and start teaching, and that's what I did. And so in 89 till now, I've been teaching. I'm pretty much working out, teaching. Yes, 1989 till now.
Gotcha. And yep. My understanding, you teach out of your home, or you have a separate space for that?
Yes, I have a dojo in my home. This is my office in my home. But downstairs, yes, I have a dojo in my home. And I teach at a dojo, which is about 20 minutes away from my house. At a 10th Planet Dojo or Iron Hold Jiu-Jitsu Dojo. So I teach Jiu-Jitsu and Judo 20 minutes away at Iron Hold Jiu-Jitsu. And I teach here in my dojo. I teach the Underground Alliance Method here. Yep.
Okay, gotcha. So you seem more self-defense focused. I'm curious, did you do any kind of competing or anything at all?
Last tournament I fought in was in 1996 in Tokyo, Japan. It was called the SA International Tournament. Yep.
And
that was the last competition. Before that, I did some point fighting here and there. But for the most part, I did some full contact stuff in Tokyo. I also, in Waterbury, Connecticut, they had Chuck Norris through some tournaments. Some kickboxing matches. I ended up winning the 1992 or 91, 92 light heavyweight kickboxing championship in Waterbury, Connecticut as well.
Yeah. Very nice. So competing in Japan, can you maybe talk a little bit about how that came about and what that was like? And I guess in contrast to competitions in America?
Well, my Aikido Jujutsu instructor, his name is Takeshi Okamoto Sensei. Takeshi Okamoto Sensei had a background in Aikido Jujutsu and Judo as well. And he trained in some form of karate or something. But he knew about a tournament in his home land. And he wanted to take some people there to fight in it. So he set up a qualifying like tournament in our dojo. And I ended up fighting and I got selected to go to Japan. So he took me to Japan, Tokyo. And it was, there's a gentleman, his name's Sakurai Shihan. He was one of Gozo Shioda's students. Gozo Shioda is an Aikido master who trained under Morihei Ueshiba, I believe. Gozo Shioda trained under Morihei Ueshiba, who, again, it's all the same circle. Aikijujutsu, Takeda Sensei, who was the 35th generation headmaster of the Daitoru Aikijujutsu clan. And then he trained Morihei Ueshiba, who broke off and created the Aikido movement. And Gozo Shioda was one of his students, but he was more, his system was more Aikijujutsu than Aikido-ish. And he trained Sakurai Shihan. And Sakurai Shihan, after Gozo Shioda died, started his own organization and then started throwing a tournament in Japan that was more geared towards Aikijujutsu and Aikido, and but it invited anybody in. And because I have a background in Aikijujutsu, I hold a Sandan in Aikijujutsu, which is the forerunner to Aikido. I hold, like I said, back in the days, at that time, I was a Sandan in karate as well. Then my rank in judo. So I got invited to that tournament through my instructor because I won the in-house tournament, and he brought me to Japan and I fought, and that was that, 1996.
And this was full contact?
Yes. Yep. Yep. No gloves, no pads, no nonsense.
Oh, very nice. Very nice. Very nice. I like it. All right. So my understanding that you've written some books.
Yes. Correct? Yes. Yeah. I have. My first book came out in 2012. It's called Insight 101, The Way of Big Power, on Author House Publications. My second book, it's called Martial Advice for Training and Living, The UA Way, published by Dorrance Publishing Company. This came out in 2020. And I'm working on my third book now, which the title, I'm still working on some things, but it's mostly done. I'm finishing up.
Gotcha. And so propelled you to want to write books?
I'm a martial arts is my life. It's not a hobby. It's this is all I do. It's all I've done since I was 6 years old. If you talk to people, they would tell you I'm obsessed with it. I'm not. I don't think obsession and dedication, fine line. So when I reach a certain rank, it becomes your majority of your training is taken from the martial arts. Taking. There comes a point in time where you have to give back. And when you reach certain ranks, certain things have to happen. Like I said, I'm a ninth dan in karate jutsu. Ninth dan, you're considered a professor. So you ideally hold a doctorate in martial arts. Part of a doctorate program is to publish some work. So that's a major part of it, is I'm giving back to the martial arts. When I die, this will always be in the Library of Congress. It will always be available to people. And so I'm giving back to the art, and it's my published work to support my doctorate in the martial sciences.
Gotcha. I like it. I like it. So we're going to got one other item that I wanted to cover before we head into what I call my lightning round here, as we move towards wrapping up. But so the other day, for the listeners, I came across you, Rob with McDojo Life does a live stream, and you popped up and chatted with him the other day, and so that's why I reached out. I liked what you were saying, and so that's why I reached out to have you on the show. But so the other day, Rob had a conversation and he was talking about being a black belt or what makes a black belt. So for many that know, especially in the jiu-jitsu world, there's this Derek Moneyberg guy that everybody's been talking about, and him getting his Brazilian jiu-jitsu black belt in 3.5 years, which is not a common thing. And there's all this talk about, oh well he's not really a black belt, you can't get a black belt in that kind of time. And it brings up the question of what makes a person a black belt. So in your eyes, your perspective, what constitutes being a black belt, earning a black belt? What does it mean to be a black belt, since there isn't a standard for what's a black belt? You know, not even if we were just talking about one system, no, not everyone has the same idea, same concept of what makes a black belt and who earns a black belt and who deserves a black belt. So I'm just kind of curious as to what you think, or what your feelings on what makes a black belt, what constitutes someone to earn a black belt.
Well, context is very important, because if we look at black belts themselves, right? I did some training in Japan, right? And I can tell you this, you can get a black belt in Japan in probably 9 months. There's children walking around with black belts in Japan. It's really not as important as people believe it to be, right? Now here, within the Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu community, you get a black belt, you're considered a professor here. You know what I mean? With that being said, everybody's different when it comes to black, when it comes to information. Everybody's different. I've had students who I show them one thing and they could do that thing, understand it to deeper levels than most, and expand off of it, no matter what I showed them. And so, let me say this. So the world believes that repetition is the key, right? Okay. I'm here to tell you that repetition, if you rep a movement, but you never truly understand the movement, your body will not adapt to that movement. Doesn't matter how many reps you do. So they say 10,000 repetitions is the key. There's no set number. This is what my new book is about, right? Shameless plug. But this is what happens, right? I show you a movement, and I'm going to bring it back around to the black belt when I say all this. All right. So I got two people. I show one person the movement, right? And I explain, I give them everything, because the way that I do it is there's concept, theory, and then physical example. So I'll give you the concept. Concept is what you want to do. I'll give you the theory behind it. Theory is why you want to do that thing. And then I'll present it physically. Right? That way I appeal to the three types of learners: the auditory, the visual, and the tactile. Right? So I'll take the tactile person, stand them in front of me, and go, okay, this is what we're going to do. And I'll demonstrate on that person. So he's getting what he needs. He's feeling the technique. I'm presenting it, demonstrating it on him, so he gets what he needs for the visual guy. The visual guy is seeing me do it and going, okay. And I'm articulating it for the auditory guy. You see what I'm saying? So everybody's getting something out of it. Okay. Then they start practicing that move. Let's say the first guy, it takes him 16 movements to really, you know, he's like, oh, wow, yeah, that makes sense. But he has a couple of questions in his mind still. And he asks those questions, and I make the, you know, I fulfill his desire to learn through his questions, right? By demonstrating some more. Those questions are answered. So 16 movements in, he asks a couple more questions. Now he does another five reps. That's 21. Now he has it, right? He goes, oh, wow, that makes sense. And then he says to his partner, yo, do this. What happens if I do this? Could I still? And his partner resists a little bit, and he does it. Another 10 movements, and he goes, wow, now we're up to 31 movements, right? And he goes, I got it. Now his hippocampus, the part of the brain, turns on and records that information because he satisfied all the information he needed. So his number was 31 for that movement. Now I see him performing that movement after the 31 reps flawlessly and making adjustments according to the changes, right, that's happening in his session, right? So 31 movements was his movement, was his number to turn on the hippocampus to record and regurgitate, right? Now he's up to 60 movements, and I watched him flawlessly for those last 30 movements, 29 movements, right? And I go, okay, you, we're doing this now. But the next guy, the other guy, is up to 700 movements, and he's still messing up. His number was 31. This guy's number is whatever. You see what I'm saying? So now, throughout the curriculum, this guy's number is low because of his ability to adapt and understand. You know what I'm saying? So it doesn't take him 10 years to get this black belt because he does it in 2 years. You see what I'm saying? But this guy, it takes him 15 years because his lack of ability to understand or how long it takes him. So there's no set number. You know what I'm saying? So this guy is walking around with a black belt on in 2 years, and they call him a prodigy now. BJ Penn, the prodigy, you know, whatever. But this guy, he's the normal guy. Oh, that's normal. It takes 15 years. Does that make him a legit black belt and him not? You understand what I mean?
Yeah. It's a individual journey for each person. Exactly. There isn't one standard for everybody.
Now, here's the thing. They say it doesn't happen in Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. BJ Penn got his in 3 years. Gio Martinez out of the 10th Planet System got his in about 3.5-4 years. Boogie Martinez, Gio's brother, got his in about 4 years in Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu or 10th Planet Jiu-Jitsu. You know what I'm saying? There's other people who have got it. In judo, we call them Batsugans. It's if you're in a tournament and you beat a bunch of black belts in the judo tournament, you'll get promoted on the mat to black belt. Just like they do in the MMA circles. You get people on MMA circles that are in there, and they're winning championships, and they're beating black belt Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu guys, choking them out. Next thing you know, somebody puts a black belt over their waist or on their shoulder as they're getting their championship belt wrapped around their, you know what I'm saying? That's an on-the-spot promotion because you were in the fire and you overcame. You know what I'm saying? And it might be 5 years in. It might be, they might have never rolled down the mat in Jiu-Jitsu class, but they've been beating Jiu-Jitsu champions who joined MMA. You know what I'm saying? Are they legit or not legit? This and that. You know, it's now as far as, you know, Moneybird goes, within Japan, there's people who have, there's people in schools, right? You have a school, and then you have your monsters that train in the basement that nobody sees until you need Mongo to come out the basement and destroy somebody. He's your pillar of the dojo that upholds your name. Then you have people who never went down in the basement and trained. They train on the main floor that people are looking in the window seeing, and they're really not too tough, but they got a lot of money and they're supporting your dojo financially. You know what I'm saying? And then you got some people, you understand what I mean? There's different types of black belts. This guy's wearing a black belt, this guy's wearing a black belt, but this guy is the guy that you call upstairs when you got a challenger in your dojo, and this guy is going to sit down, but he's going to pay his dues on time, and he's going to give you that little extra money when you got to buy a new banner or something like that. Does that mean his black belt's not legit and his not? He conquered a lot to get that black belt. He conquered a lot in within himself. This guy conquered a lot of people. You understand what I mean?
Exactly, yeah. Yeah, exactly.
There's so many things. And, you know, he paid a lot of money to all those high-level trainers that came and trained him privately. You know, he says he put over 3,000 hours on the mat training and you know, because he's a multimillionaire and he had nothing to do but pay people and train, you know?
Yeah.
Who knows?
Yeah, it's an interesting situation because you see little clips of what he's doing, and it's like skill wise, it doesn't look like much. And then, but
I agree.
Then you have these you know legends in the system in the sport, and that are vouching for him, and it's a very curious situation in. Kind of what is real and what's not, and
we all know that the UFC doesn't pay unless you're a top echelon champion, John Jones and people like that. We have UFC fighters that have fought their entire 20 years in the UFC and died broke or are broke, right? So when you get a multimillionaire willing to pay you money, you know.
Yeah, so, yeah, I don't so think I could turn it down either, so I can certainly see why there's so many of them that are doing it, so.
Yeah, so many angles you could look at it at, you know? I don't know, but I can tell you this. I'm not a stickler for time as far as if somebody's doing what they need to do and they can actually implement the lessons I gave them and they understand it. I'll go down to my dojo. When my class time hits, my door is open, right? It's unlocked. My students just come in the house, go down into the basement, and let's say my class starts at 5. Let's say the dojo's open at 5 o'clock, 5 p.m. 5:15, I'll go and I'm just standing on my stairs listening to them in the dojo. And I'll listen to them talk and they're training, they're doing whatever they're doing. And I can hear when somebody's expressing proper information and I might have a newer person down there. So my more experienced guys are saying things to them and I'm like, wow, they really understand what they're doing. Or I listen to them correcting the newer guys and I know they understand. And then they get into some stuff on the street while they're in uniform or in prison or whatever they got going on. And they've handled it, you know, or, you know, whatever the situation is. And I know they understand the information and they went through it. They left unscathed or, you know, understand. So if somebody's able to do that in 3 years and their rank, you know, it matches the understanding of a shodan or whatever it is, they're going to get promoted to that. Whether it's 3 years or 10 years. I got guys that have been with me since 1988, 89, who are still wearing white belts. You know? So I got a guy with me right now who's been with me, I don't know, a long time. He's a retired police officer. He's one of my brown belts. He's still a brown belt. He's been a brown belt for a long time. I can't cross him over because he has this one thing that just, he has a problem. He just can't get past that. You know, and I'm trying many different ways, but, and then I got people who have been with me for 5 years and they're wearing a black belt, you know?
Yeah, every journey's a little different.
Yep.
Gotcha.
Yep.
All right. So we're going to move into our lightning round here. Just got a few little questions to throw at you as we head towards wrapping up here. So first one being, do you have a favorite technique?
Not per se. No, not a favorite technique. But I do have... my favorite thing, I was just talking about this the other day. It's not a technique per se. It's just the understanding of why is what's important to me. Understanding of why. Because every tool is valuable. You know? I listened to, like, Joe Rogan talk about laughing at a kung fu guy throwing a back fist as opposed to MMA fighters overhand right. And he said, that back fist thing is nothing compared to overhand right. And my response was, you're right. A Phillips head screwdriver doesn't even come close to a adjustable wrench. Doesn't make sense. They're two different tools designed for different purposes. You see what I'm saying? So just him saying that shows his lack of understanding, you know, stuff like that. So I don't have a favorite technique, but my favorite thing is to understand the hows and whys of any technique.
Gotcha. Yeah, I like it. All right. Next question. Do you have a favorite form kata set?
No, again, no. I love kata itself because it's very valuable. People will say that katas are useless and this and that, but people who say that don't understand kata, the concept of kata and what they're designed for. You know, they look at the physical and not the essence of the physical. You know, it's designed to give you information, not designed to be written in stone. You know, so yes, I love kata. I don't have a favorite kata, no.
All right. Next question. Do you have a favorite weapon?
Yes. Katana.
Oh, very nice. Very nice. Like that. All right. Next question. If there is anyone that you could train with, living or dead, fictional or non-fictional, who would that be?
It would be Noriyasu Kudo, my instructor. He's still living. Yes. He's retired. He's a highly advanced age, but him, there's no celebrity or nothing like that. He is a celebrity in my eyes. Noriyasu Kudo, that's the person I love training with.
Great answer. I like it. All right. Then the last question there, what is something that motivates you to train? What's your kind of go-to training motivation?
My motivation for training has always been, this is going to be kind of morbid, but it's very true. My daughter's mother committed suicide, and I told my daughter I would never allow her to mourn two parents. I'd never allow her to mourn two parents. I will always be here for her. So when I worked in the prison, when I run the security at a bar/restaurant. My organization that I work for owns three bars and a package store and all this stuff. So I do security for them, run the security in the bar, run a crew of bouncers. That is my motivation for getting home every day, getting home to my daughter, not allowing her to mourn two parents. So people don't understand my motivation. My motivation is strong to get home. So no matter what's going on, I'm getting home to her safe. So that motivates me to train hard, to address violence in a very aggressive manner, so I can get home to her.
Very nice. It's a great reason. All right. So our final information to get to is shameless self-promotion. We kind of touched on that a little bit before, but now is your official time to plug anything you want, or if there's anything that maybe we didn't touch on that you wanted to make sure to get out there, now's your chance. You have the floor, and then we'll close out from there.
Thank you. Well, My name's Randy Haskins. If you ever like to see what I do or find me, you can go to Underground Alliance TV on YouTube. There's 659 videos there, 669, whatever it is, videos there of me training and some, you know, fighting and this and that. Also, again, my two books and another one to come sooner or later. I'm taking my time on that one. I'm always around. This is what I do. This is my life, my life's focus. And I just want to thank you for the opportunity to be on your show.
All right. Well, I thank you so much for taking the time to be on and sharing your story. We'll definitely have to do this at another time and get into some more items. But yeah, once again, I just thank you so much for being on and sharing your story. And I can't wait to get this out for the listeners to hear.
Thank you for listening to My Empty Hands. If you enjoyed the show, please share it with a friend. If you didn't enjoy it, please share it with an enemy. If you'd like to be a guest, or if you would like to recommend a guest for the show, please email me at podcast@talkingkenpo.com. Thank you.